So, I would like first to address this old idea of the homunculus, and then I'll come back to metagenes a little bit later to explain what I meant by this title. Now, this idea, this sort of obsolete, old-fashioned idea of the homunculus, was in a way revived years ago through the extraordinary intellectual contributions of these three persons, its filiation of thinking, Thomas Hunt Morgan, who had Albert Sturtevant as a student, who himself had Ed Lewis as a student. And Ed Lewis eventually produced this extraordinary fly, which displays two pairs of wings instead of one. And this very complex mutation is in fact due to a misregulation of one of the genes that is necessary to organize the patterns in flies, and these genes are often referred to as architect genes or Hox genes. Now, Ed Lewis also noticed that these genes come in a cluster, and the order of the genes along this gene cluster do reflect the order of the structures that these genes are building during development. It's a very interesting observation that he qualified, well, not really himself, but that his distant qualified as collinearity. About 10 years later, this notion of collinearity was extended to vertebrates, and we, as mammals, have 39 such architect genes, Hox genes. We have four little clusters of these genes in four different chromosomes. And like in flies, we implement this collinear regulation, that is, the order of the genes along these four different clusters do reflect the order of the structures that these genes determine. So it's a system that is pretty well conserved. It's not identical, but pretty well conserved. And this is because of this similarity that the New York Times in the early 90s reported this drawing of this homunculus. Since the sequence follows the body plan, it echoes the medieval notion of the homunculus, or miniature person encased in the sperm. And as you know, this idea was fantastically illustrated by Nicolas Hartsocker in his famous book, The Essai de Dioptrique, in 1694. Now, this collinear relationship is an extraordinarily precise mechanism that helps organizing structures. This is a way the mass has evolved to precisely activate transcriptionally these genes, one after the other, at the correct place. And this property has been co-opted by different axial structures during the evolution of vertebrates. Essentially, each time we produced a new axis, then nature went into these stocks of Hox genes and took some of them to help organize structure. And the best example we have of this is, of course, the limbs, the appendicular skeleton here. And if you look at this arm here, this little newborn arm, you see that there are different pieces. There's the arm, the forearm, and the hand. And you need, during development, to organize this piece. You need to identify and to produce different morphologies. So let me show you how this collinear relation, how it looks like in the case of the developing limbs. You see here pictures of these little limb buds. It's about mid gestation in mice. That would be somehow about 2 or 3 weeks in human. You see that this group of genes here in the Hox cluster, in green, from the right side to the middle, the central part, is necessary to make the upper part and the central part of the limb, the arm and the forearm. You see they're all expressed in this domain here. This is the proximal domain that will be required to build the arm and the forearm. Okay? And you see that there is another group of genes here in the other end of the cluster, number 13, number 10, that are required to build the most distal part of the limb. This expression in this very strong domain in future digits here. They will make this part here. So once again, if you look at your arm, you sort of see this chromosome and the different genes organized with the same topology as the structures will be much later during development. Now, how does that work? What is the mechanism that can translate gene topology into a series of morphology during development? Now, what I'm going to do to simplify the problem is to give you the answer, and then I'll come back to some of the details. So if you zoom out, if you look at this cluster now, and you zoom out from several megabays, you see now the cluster here, this little box here. On the right, you have gene number 1. On the left, you have gene number 13. You see that this gene cluster is flanked by two very large gene deserts. These are pieces of DNA devoid of any coding genes. Now, these two gene deserts, which are about 1 megabase large, each of them, are filled with enhancer sequences, very strong regulatory sequences. This desert here is filled with enhancers that are firing on this part of the cluster here, the right part and the central part. And these enhancers are specific to make the arm and the forearm. And on the other gene desert here, you have a range of enhancers that are firing on that part of the cluster, the other side. And these enhancers are specific to build digits. It's a very simple system indeed, in fact. Now the question, of course, is how can enhancers, which are located almost a megabase far from the target genes, how can they discriminate between this part of the cluster and that part of the cluster, which is only a couple of tenths of kilobase? To answer this question, Thomas Montavon, when he was in the lab, implemented a technology which is referred to as chromosome conformation capture. It is, in fact, very complex, but the idea is very simple. If you have a piece of DNA, you can ask, what do I contact genome-wide? What are all the pieces of DNA that at some point in a tissue are in proximity, in contact, are interacting with this piece of DNA? And what it did was to use a gene as a bait, which was on that side of the cluster number 13, and a gene, another bait, which was on the other side, number 9. When he took number 13 as a bait, he saw that most of the interaction, most of the contact, were observed in the centromeric gene desert, in this gene desert, very few on the other gene desert, meaning that gene number 13 is systematically engaged into contacting this gene desert. Okay. Now, in contrast, when he looked at gene number 9, he saw that most of the contact outside the cluster were observed on the telomeric gene desert, very little on the centromeric gene desert, meaning that these two genes have completely different tropism. Yet they are distant from one another by something like 20 to 30 kilobase. Okay? One is systematically on that side, the other one is systematically on this side. Now, if you look a little bit more in details on these contacts, Thomas could identify 7 very strong contacts. You see these red peaks here, which we call regulatory islands, and therefore we qualify this gene desert as a regulatory archipelago. Okay. And Thomas also observed that some of these contacts were present, you see it in blue here, in cells which do not express Hox genes, which do not transcribe Hox genes. And from there, he proposed that there could be 2 different conformations of this gene desert, an inactive ground state conformation here, where there is no transcription readout, and an active conformation there in cells that transcribe Hox genes. And the way I think you should see it is a sort of a poised transcriptional conformation that is silent. And then if you come with the correct factors, you will slightly change this conformation and you fire and you activate the system. Now, 1 year after the publication of this data, very interesting series of papers were reported from the laboratory of Bing Ren and collaboration between Edith Hurt Laboratory and Job Decker and also Giacomo Cavalli. They reported by looking at this interaction at a genome-wide level that the chromatin was organized into subdomains about 1 megabase large, where enhancer promoter or enhancer-enhancer or constitutive contacts were very much privileged. And this is what you see with these heat maps here. That means there's a lot of contacts there, there's a lot of contacts there, and there are little contacts in between these two so-called topologically associating domains or TADs. Now, when we extracted from this data set from Big Ren, the data corresponding to the Hox D locus here, we saw that, in fact, these two regulatory landscapes, these two gene deserts I just described, perfectly matched 2 TADs, that is, again, megabase large pieces of chromatins where contacts are very much enhanced. Now you see that there is a very strict boundary between these two TADs, as if these two sequences here would be unable to contact sequences there. And if you look at where these boundary maps within the HoxD cluster, you see that it exactly matches the difference between those genes expressing in the arm and the forearm part here, and genes not expressing number 12 and number 13. Okay? As if enhancers, which are there, specific for forearm, would be unable, be forbidden to cross and activate the genes which are on the other side of the boundary. So the way we see the system now is as follows. Get these two TADs. In between, you see the HoxD cluster here. Early on, this TAD is on, this TAD is off. The TADs contact gene from 1 to 11, and these genes together brings about the proximal part of the limb. About 1.5 days later, this TAD is switched off, and we start to understand how this is done, in fact. This TAD is switched on and contacts gene number 13 to number 8, and that helps making the distal part and fabricate the final limb. Now, this is a complex system to have two global regulations to bring about this appendicular skeleton. However, for those of you interested in paleontology, it's known for a very long time that the limbs in vertebrates and tetrapods are actually split into two large domains. There is one domain, it's a proximal domain, which is almost invariable, very highly constrained. And if you go to the museum and look at all the skeletons you can see, there's going to be systematically one bone here, two bones there. Very highly constrained. There is a second domain here that is extremely variable, highly flexible. And that's the hands and the feet, and you see all kinds of different morphologies depending on which animal you're looking at. And there again, we start to understand where this flexible and this constraint mechanism come from. It is related to the way these TADs, these different regulatory landscape, work. Another advantage of having two regulations taking care of building the limb is that if you have two different domains, you can offset the two domains and make a zone of cells here which are negative for Hox genes. And these cells make the wrist and the ankle, they make the articulation. So it means that the mechanism to build the articulation was actually built in the mechanism that produced the distal part, which makes a lot of sense, evolutionarily speaking, because making a hand and a feet without having the proper articulation would not really provide any adaptive value to the system. So this articulation between the two essential parts of our limbs, in a way, is written in the chromatin topology as a sort of an articulation between two TADs. And when you look at your arms moving like this, when you see this extraordinary articulation, you have to see two chromatin domains which are somehow articulating with one another. Now, can we see these domains? Well, Pierre Fabre, in collaboration with Elisabeth Joie and Ben Mormon, decided to label the entire TAD by using contiguous backs, so it's about 600 to 700 kilobases, and they label these TADs in red and these TADs in magenta, and they use the phosmid clone to label the HoxD cluster in green in the center. And this is these beautiful pictures you see here, these two chromatin balls here, so the two TADs, and in between here, you see the HoxD cluster. I can't resist really to show you these little limbs. This is back to the homunculus, in fact. It's sort of a metaphoric homunculus. But now you can look at this by using super resolution microscopy. This is SIM picture. These are beautiful domains, which do not merge. They never mix with one another. There's a very strong boundary between the two. And the question is, what is the nature of this intertype boundary? And is it biologically relevant? Is it necessary that we keep these two regulatory domains separated from one another? Now, the best way we have to look at the existence of this boundary is to go for chromosome conformation capture by using a bait that is an enhancer this time. We don't take a gene as a bait, but we take an enhancer sequence. Okay. So now this is number 39, a very strong enhancer in the forearm, And you see that if we use this to look at contact, you see this very strong contact with the HOXT cluster. Of course, this is the target. These are target genes. That's a good news. Okay. If you enlarge this part here, you see that you strongly contact number 8, number 9, number 10, number 11, and then it drops down again exactly where the boundary was. It goes down with 12 and almost nothing with 13. Now, for many, many years, almost 20 years, in fact, we have built the largest series of mutation, the largest allelic series in mice using a variety of genetic tricks. But it means that we do have a complete set, more than 20, 30 deletions or duplications involving this part of the cluster. So now we can start removing part of this boundary and ask, what does happen with this stat? And I'd like to show you one example which illustrates quite well what we start to see with all these deletions. And this is a deletion that removes entirely this boundary region. So what we do is we cut the piece of DNA that seems to be important for preventing these two domains to interact. And if we do this, it's a little bit complicated, but you see that when you start looking from region 39, you block here in the wild type. Here you see the deletion, in fact. In the deletion, you see you gain contact on the other side, as if now this enhancer can sort of fly over and start touching the other part, the other gene desert. However, interestingly, you see that the gains when we delete the boundary region is minimal. It's only 10 to 15% if you try and quantify these gains. It's very little, actually. And if you look at fish, you see that the domains are perfectly distinct. They don't mix more than in the wild type. And if anything, in fact, from center to center, they seem to be slightly more distant from one another. It's in the range of 700 to 800 nanometers. So it seems that the HOXT cluster, this piece we removed, is maybe even used to make the structure a little bit more compact. Now, therefore, it seems that TADs may exist without a boundary. However, the boundary region makes local insulation much more efficient. And I'd like to show it to you. Now, you see that, as I showed you, when you remove this boundary here, you start contacting there. But you see there is a very robust activation, very robust contact with a gene that is right after the deletion. This gene is there, is not contacted when the boundary region is there, which means that the fact in the wild-type condition the gene is not contacted has nothing to do with the promoter affinity or whatever. The gene can be contacted, but when you have this boundary region, it isn't contacted. So the question, of course, is it biologically relevant? Is it necessary that the telomeric TAD, these enhancers, do not interact with the most centromeric 12 and 13 genes? And the answer is yes. It is very important to prevent this interaction. And the reason is that number 13 is a dominant negative, is a protein that kills the function of every other HOXT genes where it is co-expressed with. So you need to prevent gene number 13 and 12 to respond to the enhancers that are on the other side. And I show you here one example of what happens when you do that. This is a very old paper we published in 1996. We had observed the phenotype. We had no clue of the explanation of this phenotype. But you see that due to a particular manipulation, we could express number 13 now in the arm and forearm region here, whereas it should not normally be expressed there. And immediately, you see what we call a mesomelic dysplasia, a very strong malformation of the arm and the forearm. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of mesomelic dysplasia in human families that do map to this region of the chromosome, the syntenic chromosome, which is called the sensitive region of 2Q31 in human, and we start, of course, to understand the etiology of this system. Now, let me briefly go to the concept of metagene. So this is the regulatory logic, which I just told you at the HOXT locus. This is little complex of genes, this cluster of genes here, and you see that all the importance, rather than being given to the gene itself, as it was in the 70s and 80s, which we heard about from Nicole before, the importance of the system is given to these enhancers. It's a very small cluster, huge enhancer regions. Okay. In fact, this gene cluster could almost be analogize to one gene with several isoforms. In fact, the genes are not so important in this system. What is important is the regulation, and hence the sort of poor but existing analogy with the operon. We refer to these as metagenes, and I'm telling you why in a minute. Now, how could this system evolve? How could such amount of different enhancers accumulate in these gene deserts? To discuss this point, I need to go back to the structure of these Hox clusters. And in fact, if you look at all animals that have been sequenced thus far, it still starts to be quite a number, invertebrates, vertebrates, you see that these gene clusters come under different flavors. Some animals have no cluster at all. Genes have been scattered throughout the genome. Some animals have a cluster that is split. This is the case of Drosophila, other insects. Some animals have disorganized clusters, very large cluster, about a 1 megabase large, and some animal, interestingly enough, very, very tightly organized gene cluster, metagenes. Now, of course, the question, interesting question for those of you interested in the evolution of development, is which animal do have what? And if you look at the phylogeny, very schematized phylogeny, you see that essentially all animals have all type of clusters, all animal groups, all taxon. You can go to Lophotrochosans, to Ecdysozoans, arthropods, or annelids, or whatever. You will see disorganized, split, atomized. However, you will never see a fully organized gene cluster in any other taxon than invertebrates. And in addition, all vertebrates will display this very tightly organized distribution of Hox genes in their cluster. So we need to explain that. How is this possible? I think there are two ways one can explain this particular observation. The first one is that our common ancestor, the Bilateria, had a tightly organized cluster, and it was maintained all through the lineage leading to vertebrates. And it became disorganized and split in all other animals. In fact, this reminds me a lot of this sentence, which I took from the Evolution Créatrice. La route que nous parcourons dans le temps est jonchée des débris de ce que nous commencions d'être, de tout ce que nous aurions pu devenir. That's a beautiful sentence from Henri Bergson. However, in fact, if you look at this a little bit in detail, you realize rapidly that this is close to intelligent design. It's virtually impossible to think that we would be the image, the only image of our bilaterian ancestors. So we're left with the second explanation, which is what we call the consolidation model, which is the ancestral bilaterian animal had a disorganized gene cluster. And then it became split, or it remained disorganized, or it was atomized in a variety of different animals. And then it became organized on the way leading to vertebrates. Now, that is a complex concept to deal with, because, as you know, usually we see evolution as a sort, a little bit like an entropic process. We tend to think that things are organized and become disorganized in the course of evolution. So what happened at that place here that could help understand this consolidation process? Well, as you know, here two genome duplication occurred on the way to vertebrates. And this is why we tend to have four times the amount of genes that Drosophila or nematodes have, because we are octoploid flies, in fact. And we believe that because of this gene duplication, it gave some rooms to consolidate the vertebrate cluster. And this is the mechanism we proposed some time ago that would occur. This is a disorganized cluster. If are in our ancestor, one cluster. These genes are occupied to activate collinearity in the trunk to organize their major body axes, because worms need this and Drosophila need that. Okay. And at some point, a global enhancer started to evolve at one extremity. Why? At one side of the cluster, not inside. Well, because you don't want to disturb this collinear mechanism. So you need to bring that stuff outside. Okay. Now, why evolving this? Well, because that has a lot of adaptive value. You have to realize that all these proteins have the same binding, close to the same binding affinities. So by bringing them under the control of global enhancers, you can start evolving dosage effect. You can start evolving compensatory mechanism, redundancy, all these things. Has a lot of adaptive values. Now, at some point, the system is blocked because you cannot play around with these ancestral co-inner mechanism. However, if you duplicate the system, much like gene neofunctionalization, which was proposed by Ono in his very interesting book, you can have a sort of a metagene neofunctionalization by adding more and more of these enhancer sequences, because you will compensate what you lose on one with the other. Okay? Now, along with accumulating these enhancer sequences, the cluster will optimize, will maximize its response, its transcription response to them, and will become progressively better organized. So this is the way we think this system happened. Now, of course, that left us with the question, why, which factor may have triggered such an accumulation of enhancers outside the Hox cluster? Why so many enhancers outside the Hox cluster, global enhancers? Okay. This is an important question because, as I said, we believe that this is the accumulation of these enhancers that led to a consolidation of the cluster. Now, here I'd like to come back to this TAT structure, and what we would like to propose is that potentially a very important parameter in this enhancer recruitment was the existence of these constitutive domains, of these TADs, of these domains I showed you by DNA fish. Okay. If one assumes that you have these things preformed, that they are poised, that they are ready to fire, that there is a transcription readout that is that's very high adaptive value, then one can start thinking, I think rather easily, that you can bring new keys very easily. The problem is the first. The problem is the pioneer enhancer that will start making the structure. Once the structure starts to work, then it becomes much easier to bring new enhancers and evolve this pleiotropy. Now I'd like to terminate by showing you one quick example of this. And this is the gene number 13 again, that is on that side. And this gene is expressed at the ends of things. It is the gene that terminates. It is at the end of the gut. It is at the end of the limbs. It is at the end of the trunk. And it is at the end of the external genital system here. So you see number 13 here, strongly expressed in the distal limbs, in the digit, in the genitals. And Nicolas Lonfard, when he was a student in the lab, decided to look if the expression in the genitals was controlled by the same TAD than the expression in digits. So he ran this 4C analysis. And just to make it very simple, you see that most of the peaks are conserved. That is, if you look at this regulatory domain in digits, it's like this. If you look in genitals, it's like that. Very, very small difference between the two type of regulations. However, you see that some of the peaks are different. Here the peak is present in digit, absent from genital, present in genital, absent in digit. So there are very, very minor differences within the contacts in these regulatory domains. If you take this peak and go into transgenic mice, you see this beautiful expression in digits, nothing in genitals. If you take that peak and go into transgenic mice, you see beautiful expression in genitals, nothing in digits. So they are very specific enhancers, which we believe took advantage of these structures to come and plug in. In this particular case, I'd like to finish with this, it is very difficult to know which one came first. Because in fact, external genitals and digits have very comparable adaptive values. They go back to the Devonian, the colonization of the terrestrial environment, and both structures appeared probably in a short window of time, so it's difficult to know which one came first. If you go to the other gene desert, where you see, for example, enhancers for mammary glands and for the forearm, I think it's going to be much easier for us to trace back the phylogeny of these enhancers, and this is what we are trying to do now. With this, I'd like to terminate. I'd like to show you my lab. I mentioned the names of the persons involved in what I said. And if I may, in the last dernière 30 secondes, j'aimerais évoquer très, très brièvement ma première rencontre avec François Jacob. J'en ai eu quelques-unes, extrêmement intéressantes. Et, c'était une rencontre à un congrès à Cold Spring Harbor en 1985. probablement le congrès le plus extraordinaire auquel j'ai eu la chance d'assister. C'est là que tous les principes fondamentaux, les grands concepts de la nouvelle biologie du développement ont été énoncés. C'était peu après le clonage de l'homme au box, comme l'a mentionné Nicole de Doirin ce matin. Et j'ai rencontré François Jacob. Vous voyez que nous n'étions pas très proches l'un de l'autre. À cette occasion, pour des raisons que je ne souhaite pas mentionner, mais pour extra-scientifique, nous avions une conversation dans les jardins de Cold Spring Harbor. Et à la fin de cette conversation, il m'avait demandé, par curiosité probablement, ce que je faisais. Je lui avais donc répondu que j'étais postdoc chez Pierre Chambon et que nous commencions à travailler sur la structure de ces clusters à l'époque qui n'étaient pas connus. Et il m'avait dit, et ça me rappelle beaucoup ce qu'a mentionné Nicole à la fin de son magnifique exposé, il m'avait dit, surtout n'abandonnez pas la souris, car c'est grâce à sa génétique que de très grandes surprises vont sortir. Et c'est quelque chose que j'ai gardé en mémoire. C'était exactement il y a 30 ans, pratiquement jour pour jour, en fait, en 1985. Et c'est pour cette raison que j'étais spécialement heureux d'être là ce matin. Je remercie Edith et Alain d'avoir convié à cette journée. Je vous remercie.